pretty resilient about a lot of things in life. She's a teeny little thing, very petite, but she's full of spunk, hungry for life.
An Alaskan who survived the Haiti earthquake recovers from her injuries in Miami. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 14th of January. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, polar bear biologists encounter thin ice on a unique trip to the polar basin.
Sometimes a bear would walk on the sea ice and you could see it undulate like a waterbed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. When you file your PFD online, your donation through Pick, Click, and Give can make a huge difference in the lives of Alaskans. Your contribution can lend a hand to Alaskans worried about their next meal or help children who suffer abuse and neglect. Your generosity can help provide shelter for a homeless Alaskan whose average age is just 9 years old. Go to pickclickgive.org and select your favorite cause and be the person who sets it all in motion. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
State and federal officials are tight-lipped about federal search warrants that were issued for Chevron's Alaska facilities in Cook Inlet on Tuesday and Wednesday. John Cutterbach with the State Department of Environmental Conservation's Division of Air Quality confirmed that both DEC and the EPA began investigating a potential non-compliance issue with Chevron in 2008. Cutterbach said DEC suspended its investigation last winter to let EPA take the lead in pursuing the matter. EPA Regional Deputy Director Greg Kellogg referred calls to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Anchorage U.S. Attorney spokesman Chuck Farmer said EPA special agents executed the search warrants. This was confirmed by the Department of Justice. Chevron issued a statement to APRN this afternoon acknowledging that EPA has been investigating air emission compliance at the Trading Bay facility and the Granite Point tank farm since 2008 and that the company is cooperating. Both facilities are in Cook Inlet. An Alaskan woman who was caught in the earthquake in Haiti is in good spirits today, even though she had to have her foot amputated. Krista Brelsford was teaching adult literacy south of Port-au-Prince when the quake hit. She fell running down a set of stairs, and her legs were trapped under the crumbling building. She was evacuated to Miami, where she had surgery late yesterday. Her brother Julian, who was working with her in Haiti but was not injured, joined her there this morning. Krista described her ordeal to a TV news crew.
Julian and a couple of other guys, the Haitian guys, eventually it took about, I think, half an hour to get my right leg free. And as soon as I could see that, I turned around and I could see that it was disconnected, basically. I'm so thankful to be alive. There are so many ways in the last 2 days that I could have been dead that I'm just thankful that I'm not. And I'm terribly sorry for all the people in Haiti, the Haitians especially, who don't have the level of medical care that I'm getting.
Krista's dad, Taylor, and his wife are in Anchorage. They're flying to Miami tomorrow to reunite with their kids. Taylor says they first heard from Krista from a UN camp in Haiti.
So she was able to send us an email note saying that she was trapped in the rubble, but the men were able to free her. She was at this camp and being well cared for. Her injury to her foot was serious. I think she said something to the effect of on her right lower leg that it might not survive, but she was safe, well cared for, very anxious to get back to the U.S. and anxious that we start everything possible for an evacuation.
And so she's in Miami now. Have you talked to her since she arrived there?
Yes. She phoned about 6 o'clock last night, just for 30 seconds. She said, I've just landed. They're putting me in an ambulance. I'm borrowing somebody's phone, but I'm pretty good. I'm here. And, even a couple of seconds was enough to really lift the cloud for us. Her physician called later, her orthopedic surgeon called us about midnight last night to say that the surgery had gone fairly well. She was confident that they had been able to kind of clean the wound, ensure that there would not be infections and so on, but there would be some additional surgeries probably in the days to come, and that they had not been able to save her foot, that the damage and the injury was too severe. They were hopeful and still are that this can be below the knee, that they would not have to amputate up any further. The other thing the surgeon said that was, you know, touching to us was that she was quite startled at how positive Krista was about this, you know, life-changing event, that she just seemed to have nothing but a positive attitude going forward.
Have you talked to Krista today?
No, not yet. She's been busy, I see. So Ethan, her boyfriend, was able to arrive from New York early this morning and called me from the hospital about 8:30 or so to say that Krista was doing very well. The nurses actually had her up out of bed, and that her spirits were good. She really didn't seem to require a lot of the pain meds. She seemed to be doing just very welcome under the circumstances. About an hour later, the phone rang. My cell phone rang again, and the little deal says, Ethan, and I pick it up, and it was Julian calling from the room. He had been on an early morning evacuation from Haiti and was now at the hospital, and I just busted into tears. It was the craziest thing to hear his voice and to know that both of our kids are now safe.
Taylor, your daughter has, as you said, an amazingly positive attitude about this, what must have been a horrific event. What do you attribute that to?
She's had a lot of spunk all of her life. I mean, I hope we will have raised our kids to live a life of service, to be concerned about others, all of those things. And maybe that's a part of it, that she just, I think she's got a pretty good inner moral compass and is able to adapt. And she's pretty resilient about a lot of things in life. She's a teeny little thing, very petite. But she's full of spunk, hungry for life.
What would you want other Alaskans to know about this tragedy in Haiti and your children being there at that time?
This suffering continues on an absolutely devastating scale, and we are very anxious that people share in our joy, but turn their care to the ongoing humanitarian aid. We plead with people to be a part of the continuing efforts at direct humanitarian aid and longer-term development in Haiti. We will be loyal for our lifetime to the little program, to the people who saved our kids.
Taylor Brelsford's daughter, Krista, was badly injured in the Haiti earthquake. The proposed Arctic Link fiber optic cable from Japan to the United Kingdom would bring faster internet to Unalaska and Prudhoe Bay, but not to other parts of Western Alaska. The Kodiak Kenai Cable Company announced a plan to build a fiber optic express highway that connects Europe and Asia by way of the Northwest Passage. The route will go from Japan through the North Pacific, stop in Unalaska, go up the western coast of Alaska to Prudhoe Bay, then through the Northwest Passage, south of Greenland, to connect to London. The company's technical consultant, Ike Eichardt, says it's actually the shortest route between the edges of the continents.
Really, for the first time, telecommunications link is now possible up and over the Arctic. And the real beauty of the system is that it cuts almost in half the transmission time, the transmission delay for international communications.
Eckhard says laying the cable in the Arctic, which is covered in ice for most of the year, creates some challenges but can also be beneficial. Eckhard says the ice serves as a protective layer and prevents people, fishing equipment, and forces of nature from hurting the marine cable in the winter. Along the route, the cable has to come to land in Unalaska and Prudhoe Bay to connect with regenerators. They power the cable to keep the signal going.
There is a low element of power that goes into them to power repeaters along the links on the seafloor, so that the power is regenerated and reinjected in the system, and the digital telecommunications transmission is also regenerated.
The Arctic Link project is different from the Northern Fiber Optic Link project, which was aimed at bringing high-speed internet to all of the communities in western Alaska. The Kodiak Kenai Cable Company is still waiting to hear if they will receive federal stimulus funds for that project. The Arctic Link project is completely separate and will go forward even if the NFOL project does not. That means only Unalaska and Prudhoe Bay would become part of the fiber optic network and get access to faster internet connections. The Kodiak Kenai Cable Company, which is owned by two native corporations, will partner with International Telecommunications and Energy Company, ConNet, to pay for the $1.2 billion project. Construction is scheduled to begin in 2011 and would be completed by 2013. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Sitka man whose houseboat was wiped out in a bad storm.
So I lost everything. I did manage to save some clothes, but I lost everything that was personal property, my Bible.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Judge John Sedgwick has ruled that the evidence prosecutors failed to turn over to Pete Kott's defense was not enough to have made a difference in his conviction on corruption charges. The former state legislator will remain free pending appeal. Sedgwick said it was true that some of the information federal prosecutors failed to give Kott's lawyer could have helped his defense, but he said much of it he would not have allowed to be admitted as evidence anyway. That evidence involved personal conduct of key witness Bill Allen. Governor Sean Parnell today said he will introduce legislative amendments to the state's petroleum revenue structure to give more investment incentives and tax credits to oil producers and explorers in exchange for new jobs he anticipates would come from increased development. The incentives could reduce state income by as much as $1 billion a year, according to the governor's description.
I'm looking for jobs now, and that's what I'm here for when it comes to Alaskans. So they will only get the credit if they make that investment, and that investment means jobs. It means there's no other way around it. If they make the investment, there are more jobs for Alaskans.
The governor's plan came after a Department of Revenue review of the current tax structure found that the tax regime adopted in 2007 was highly successful. Called the ACES system, it increased the state's revenue over the two previous methods of oil and gas taxation. Under ACES, the state collected $6.8 billion in fiscal year 2008, a year of very high oil market prices. That same year, it would have collected $4.2 billion under the plan the Murkowski administration put in place. Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin said the analysis also showed that the company's operating and capital expenditures rose since ACES became effective, and employment numbers have risen to the highest level in history. However, Galvin said it's premature to attribute those increases to the ACES structure. Governor Parnell says those numbers could be better, however, and that's why he believes the tax changes are needed. A recent expedition over the deep waters of the Arctic Ocean is giving scientists new insight into how polar bears exist in that extreme environment. An icebreaker equipped with a helicopter made it possible for biologists to capture bears for the first time in the middle of the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas last fall. The data currently being analyzed from the trip will make it easier to predict how the species will respond to climate change. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The biologists knew the ice would be thin in the Arctic Ocean in October, but just how thin? That was a bit of a surprise.
For example, sometimes a bear would walk on the sea ice and you could see it undulate like a waterbed. So it's that thin as the bear moves over it.
Eric Regeer is a biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's collaborating with the University of Wyoming on the study. 2009 recorded the third lowest level of Arctic sea ice. Besides that, Regeer says October was unseasonably warm, and that made for challenging conditions as the biologists worked to recapture 10 bears that had been fitted with GPS tracking collars near Alaska's North Slope last spring.
So whereas polar bears have big feet like snowshoes and can walk on thin ice and are experts at judging which ice is safe, we're not. And we had several biologists and a helicopter attempting to work on that same ice. And in many cases, we'd find a bear and be able to observe it, get a look at it, but not be able to capture it safely because it was on ice that was just too thin.
In the end, the biologists were able to recapture four of the radio-collared bears. They got tantalizingly close to five others and took measurements and blood samples on more than a dozen bears without radio collars. Bears so far north in October are waiting for the sea ice to reform and bring them back south over the productive waters of the continental shelf. They should be at their fattest after a summer of gorging on seal blubber. Regeer says the biologists did find healthy-looking bears, but those were mostly single animals. Females with cubs were another story.
Some of the adult females with cubs were very thin, so in poor nutritional condition. And although these are resilient animals and it's hard to predict what will happen to those bears, the chances, especially of those thin cubs making it through the harsh winter, seem quite low.
At the beginning of the icebreaker trip, the biologists located a radio-collared female with a cub in tow. They couldn't capture her at the time, but when they found her again 3 weeks later, her cub had vanished.
Now, in the intervening weeks, there had been a big storm with rough seas. It had really broken up the sea ice, and we suspect that because young polar bears are not strong swimmers, during that time, the cub was probably lost to the mother and likely drowned. And indeed, that highlights one of the concerns about sea ice loss and climatic warming for polar bears, is that when the ice is more broken up and the seas are rougher, smaller bears that are weaker swimmers have a more difficult time getting from A to B and may face an increased chance of drowning.
But Regeer says it was eye-opening for him to see how well the bears did, despite the thin ice conditions. And he says it was fascinating to see the deep waters of the polar basin for the first time. It's a part of the world scientists know very little about. What they do know is that the water north of the continental shelf is generally less productive. But Regeer says after seeing the landscape up close, he understands the real story is more complicated. At one point, he could see six polar bears from the icebreaker.
And so for some reason, there were areas out there in this huge region that held great concentrations of polar bears at very high densities. For example, perhaps there was a whale that had been killed or died and floated to the surface, although we didn't observe it. Other areas, we travel for tens and hundreds of miles and not only see no polar bears, but see no tracks of polar bears, no tracks of Arctic foxes, no seals, and no bird life. So there's an amazing amount of ecological patchiness and complexity out there that we're only beginning to appreciate.
This study will help scientists learn just how productive the polar basin might be. Regeer wants to know whether the bears he captured in the region were eating or fasting. That finding will have a big impact on predicting how the species will respond as the ice continues its retreat. And as Regeer struggled to find strong enough ice to capture polar bears, those frustrations also help drive home a point.
It is somewhat ironic that research into the effects of climatic warming on polar bears was, from a practical perspective, greatly hindered by sea ice loss, which is the very phenomenon we're trying to study and indeed is the greatest challenge facing the species throughout the Arctic.
The bears Regeer studied this fall couldn't wait to get back to the continental shelf. He says they were lined up along the edge of the ice waiting for it to reform, like a defensive line preparing for the snap of a football. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If heating your home costs more than you can manage and you have a low income, the state of Alaska has heating assistance programs that may help. The programs have expanded to include families with a higher household income. For information or an application form, call 1-800-470-3058 or visit heatinghelp.alaska.gov. Sometimes a little help makes all the difference. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A group of soldiers in the Fort Richardson Explosive Ordnance Detail arrived in Kodiak yesterday afternoon to inspect an unexploded World War II bomb. The ordnance was donated to the Kodiak Military History Museum by a local resident. Until a few years ago, the bomb had been on display in front of a Kodiak bar. Upon examination of the bomb, the museum's director determined that it was more than just an interesting artifact. The bomb still contained dunite, a highly explosive material also known as Explosive D. Explosive experts took the bomb to a remote area of a firing range on Kodiak and detonated the device. While the bomb had lost some of its boom after 60 years, it did go out with a bang. The visiting soldiers recorded the event on video and salvaged a piece of the bomb for display at the Kodiak Military History Museum. A year ago, sliding snow severed the capital city from low-cost hydroelectric power for 21 days, forcing Juneau's utility company to burn expensive diesel fuel. The January 2009 avalanche was the second in a year along the Snettisham transmission line, the first hit in April 2008. Since the second avalanche, Alaska Electric Light and Power has made some changes. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has the story.
The 2008 and 2009 avalanches knocked down Snettisham Transmission Tower 3-5. That structure has now been permanently removed. A massive steel diverter has been built around Tower 4-6, and the Lake Dorothy Hydroelectric Project is online. AEL&P generation engineer Scott Willis says the Snettisham line is more secure this winter than ever before.
So the two towers that were hit in 2008 and one of them again in 2009, are out of the picture now, either gone or protected.
In October, the company completed installation of a large steel column and beam structure bolted to the bedrock, protecting Snettisham Tower 4-6.
That diversion structure is a massive steel structure about 40 feet tall. If you imagine an angle, it's a two-sided triangle, uphill of the structure, pointing uphill. And the idea is if an avalanche comes down, that diversion structure splits the avalanche to go around each side of the tower.
A Snettisham repair fund covered the cost of the $2 million structure, as well as $900,000 in line repair from last year's slide. The diesel burn during the period totaled $3.8 million, absorbed by ratepayers over a month when residential rates temporarily increased from 9.6 cents a kilowatt hour to 24 cents.
The cost of the repairs and the cost of the diversion structure came out of a fund that Snettisham has to do sort of major projects like this. These were unexpected projects, and so we'll have to, over time, restore that fund. So this will eventually find its way into rates, but at a very small amount over a long period of time.
Again this year, Alaska avalanche specialists provide daily forecasting along the Snettisham line and control the snow with explosives when conditions require. But avalanche specialist Mike Jane says this winter is off to a slow start compared to last year.
We have conducted 6 missions in mile 4 of the power line this year compared to 7 last year. However, we have used quite a bit less explosives on these missions, largely due to removal of Tower 3-5 with a span over the East Crater Bull runout.
In anticipation of the current weather cycle, Jane says crews sent off charges on Tuesday, cleaning out snow before it piled up and slid naturally. And lead avalanche forecaster Jay Bristow will remain at Snettisham Power Plant until the weather clears. Meanwhile, the Lake Dorothy Hydroelectric Project has been operating since August, giving Juneau additional security. Willis says it will save a lot of expensive diesel fuel.
The Lake Dorothy Project can't completely replace Snettisham, but it can replace a lot of the diesel that we would have to burn if Snettisham was not online. I ran some numbers at the end of the 2008 avalanche and calculated that had Lake Dorothy been online, it would have saved us about 40% of the diesel that we generated in the 2008 avalanche.
Lake Dorothy is currently providing about 20% of Juneau's power. The project will be shut down for about 4 months this summer, but Willis says the company will not have to run diesel. In Juneau, I'm Rosemary Alexander.
In November, we brought you a series on homelessness in Sitka. Just days after those stories aired, another Sitkan became homeless. Here's KCAW's Ed Ronco with a report about a man named Rusty Sutton, a boat called the Sea Dog, and the storm that changed everything.
50-year-old Rusty Sutton came to Sitka in May to buy a wooden boat. That deal didn't work out, and he ended up with the Sea Dog, a 27-foot fiberglass boat built in 1968. The Sea Dog became Sutton's home.
It was in good
fairly good condition, and not excellent condition, but in good condition.
He had his computer on board along with some DVDs and CDs, all of his clothes, and books about World War I and World War II. And it made a decent home as spring turned to summer and summer turned to fall. But you'll notice I'm talking in the past tense, because on the weekend of November 13th, everything changed.
I was with a friend of mine, and another friend of mine came up and told him in this conversation we were having, he asked me if I heard about the storm coming in, and I said, no, I hadn't heard anything. He said there was a strong storm coming in and that I should call the harbor master and get protection for me and my boat for the weekend. I said, that's a good idea.
Sutton asked if he could move into a stall closer to shore, a request he says was denied. So he went out to his boat, checked his lines, and hoped for the best. The best is not what happened.
So I lost everything. I did manage to save some clothes, but I lost everything that was personal property, my Bible, my TV, my VHS machine.
And his home. He's challenging the city on who's responsible for his boat breaking free. And because of the possibility of legal action, city officials said they couldn't talk about his case. When we interviewed him, Sutton was staying at the Sitka Hotel on a Salvation Army voucher. That's run out, and now he's sleeping back at one of the harbors, but not aboard a boat.
I have an old pickup truck. It's got a bench seat in the back, behind the driver's seat, and that's where I'll be staying. I have no family here, and the closest family I have is in northwest Montana.
He's explored different community services for help. Some have worked out, some haven't. He says if he was living in a house and it was destroyed, his story might be different.
But when it comes to liveaboard boats, people don't look at a liveaboard boat as they do as a home. Now, here in the city, if a house catches fire, neighbors, friends, family would all get together, find a place for them to stay, replace their clothes, give them help with money or a place to live. And that doesn't happen with liveaboard boat owners.
Sutton says he's been without permanent shelter before. He hitchhiked in the lower 48 when he was a lot younger, but even then he had family he could stay with. Now he's in his truck, wondering what will happen next. He's not without a sense of irony, though. Some of those books he lost had to do with his hobby of studying shipwrecks.
Now I'm owner of a shipwrecked boat. Basically, it's a total loss. Everything inside, all the electronics that the boat had on board, are ruined.
Sutton's boat was the only one to break loose that night, and in many regards, it was just a typical scene after a strong storm in a part of the world where such things are not terribly uncommon. For Sutton, though, it was much more than that. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Diana Gish in Kodiak, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com,
and by
BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.